Neuroscientist V.S. Ramachandran is renowned for his ability to crack strange neurological mysteries, from patients who think they're dead to people with phantom limb syndrome. His work has not only helped cure his patients, it's also led to new insights into our neural pathways. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Ramachandran to talk about his research.
You are perhaps most famous for your studies of various rare neurological disorders, phantom limbs in particular. So tell me, why do some people who've lost an arm through amputation still feel that they actually have this arm?
Well, there are several reasons. One reason is the very mundane reason that the nerves originally supplied the hand are now supplying the stump and form little bits of scar tissue. And when those little clumps of scar tissue are activated, they're going to activate the same area of the brain that once represented the hand. So you think that the hand is still there. The higher areas in the brain that interpret those signals are fooled into thinking that the hand is still there. But this can't be the whole story because you can remove those irritating neurons or you can anesthetize a stump and you still feel the phantom.
And what's striking is that, I mean, for people who have this problem, this phantom limb syndrome, I mean, they can have serious pain, chronic pain that drives them crazy.
Right. And one of the things we noticed was that, well, first of all, patients with phantom limbs can move their phantom, the majority of them. And why does this happen? Well, the front of the brain sends normally, let's forget about phantom limbs, let's take you and me. Front of the brain sends commands down the spinal cord to the arm to move the arm in a specific way, goal-directed manner, reach out and grab the peanut. But in parallel, a copy of that command is sent to the parietal lobe where you construct your body image. You close your eyes, you have a vivid sense of your different body parts moving. And then you open your eyes, you also see the arm moving. All of these bits of information converge to construct your body image in the parietal lobe. Now, even when your arm is removed, the feed forward, the command signals go to the parietal lobe. And what happens is you get rid of the arm, but what you now have is a phantom arm in a phantom sling with phantom pain.
But the pain is real in the sense that there are actual nerves triggering the pain. I mean, they're not just imagining this.
Absolutely. For a long time, many psychologists thought that phantom sensations, including phantom pain, were quote-unquote purely psychological, or some said they are even quote-unquote imaginary, whatever that means. This is very insulting to the patient because the pain for the patient is as real as if I were to poke you with a hot poker. But the question is, why does the pain arise? One reason is the pain that was there when the arm was intact, every time the brain sent a command to the arm move, it was getting feedback saying, no, it's not moving. And brain abhors discrepancy, and sometimes the discrepancy itself, for some peculiar reason, is felt as being extraordinarily unpleasant and painful. So we said, if this is the incongruence that's leading to the pain, then can we do something to alleviate the pain by restoring the phantom limb, making the phantom limb reappear visually?
And I have to say, I mean, one of the pleasures of reading about your work is you made an absolutely ingenious remedy for this, not using any kind of fancy technology at all, but a simple mirror. Can you explain what you did?
Well, let's assume the patient's left arm is amputated. Let's say you're the patient and your left arm is amputated and you're sitting in front of a table and your left arm is a phantom and it's excruciatingly painful and is an awkward, clenched position and you can't open the fist and you wish you could open it, but you can't. What I do is put a mirror, prop it up vertically in front of you. And you can try this at home, any person listening to this program. You don't need a box or anything. You just need a mirror propped up with two bricks with the mirror propped up vertically so that it's parallel to your nose. So what you then do is you put your right hand, which is a normal hand, on the right side of the mirror, the shiny side of the mirror, and look at the reflection of the normal hand inside the mirror. And it looks like the phantom has been resurrected, patient of the phantom limb. Suddenly, you optically resurrected the phantom limb by this simple, very simple procedure. But now it gets better. If you now send bilaterally symmetrical commands to both arms to do similar actions like conducting an orchestra, clapping, waving goodbye, while looking in the mirror, the brain is sending a command to the phantom to move, to wave goodbye, but he's now getting visual feedback because of the reflection, saying that the phantom arm is actually resurrected and obeying his command. So this is now being widely adopted in clinics throughout the United States, especially after the Gulf War, and throughout the world, actually, as a simple procedure to relieve phantom pain.
Even though the patient knows that this is a trick, consciously, I mean, of course, you know that you're missing this arm, but somehow by seeing this with this mirror trick, it tricks the brain to getting rewired in a way, is what it sounds like.
Well, that's correct. It's as though the use of visual feedback to correct pain and all of that is all on autopilot in your brain. And eventually the messages get sent to consciousness and you become aware of it. But the early processing is all on autopilot, and that's where you're tricking the brain. You're not tricking your higher level conceptual intellectual centers. They know what's going on. The guy knows it's a mirror. You may have seen optical illusions like one line looking longer than the other. You put a ruler there, you know they're the same length, but they look different in length. But the brain cannot resist the illusion. You still see the illusion, even if you know intellectually they're the same length.
This is just astonishing. I mean, these kinds of remedies that you've come up with. And I have to say, I mean, part of the thing that's astonishing about it is the technology you're using. I mean, you're not talking about very expensive brain scanning machines that you're putting people in to try to figure out what's going on. I mean, you're talking about simple technology like a mirror that you can buy at the five and dime store.
Yes. Well, I trained in medicine in India. And at that time when I trained, there was very little fancy equipment available. And one of the advantages of not having any equipment is it forces you to be resourceful. Maybe that lingers on in my brain, that frame of mind. But I think that there's too much imaging going on. Some of it's going to be very useful, at least by accident. But it's become a toy. And if you give a five-year-old a knife, it's going to go cut everything in sight. So I think science should be problem-driven, not technology-driven. Not to say that technology doesn't play an important role. I mean, think of biology without a microscope, but astronomy without a telescope. But I think more and more people take the easy way out and say, well, let's see what lights up. Let's see what lights up when you do this. Let's see what lights up. If you go to conferences, you see lots and lots of this going on. And I think we need to be more concept-driven and question-driven, problem-driven rather than technology-driven.
V.S. Ramachandran talking with Steve Paulson. Ramachandran directs the Center for Brain and Cognition at the University of California, San Diego. His book is called The Telltale Brain.